Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, April 27th. First comes expanded testing, then comes contact tracing. That's what Governor Andrew Cuomo announced last week about how New York will be able to reopen. The goal is 40,000 coronavirus tests a day, and then trace those positive cases, see who they come in contact with to limit further outbreaks. And then comes the question of who and where to quarantine. Here's what else we know. New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut will work together in the same contact tracing effort. This will start going on around the country, too. Thousands of new disease detectives, as they're being called, people whose job it is to track the virus's movement, will need to be hired. And former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is footing part of the bill, contributing $10 million to get contact tracing off the ground. In comparison, he spent $1 billion on his failed presidential campaign, but it's a start. The tri-state region will also partner with Johns Hopkins University and the nonprofit called Vital Strategies to roll out the contact tracing program. With me now to talk about what contact tracing entails and what it can accomplish and some of the hurdles is David Harvey. He's the executive director of the D.C.-based National Coalition of STD Directors, an association that is no stranger to contact tracing. They usually focus on controlling outbreaks of sexually transmitted diseases, but now they're beginning to work with states to track the spread of COVID-19. David, thank you for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Most listeners might not have heard of contact tracing before this all started. Now everybody's hearing of it, but your organization has been doing it for a long time. Can you describe how contact tracing has already been used in our society?
Yeah, we actually have a very long history of doing contact tracing in the United States, going back all the way to post-World War II. And so this is a very essential core function of public health programs in the United States and an important kind of locus of expertise has long been present in the STD field, formerly called, of course, venereal diseases. So these, what is being called in the media, disease detectives, we call them STD contact tracers, and the real formal name in the public health system is disease intervention specialists. So there's an existing workforce now in the United States that does this work. And we think they're a central group of folks who have expertise to bring to COVID.
Talk about the differences, though. I mean, with sex partner tracing, it's just those few, usually few, intimate contacts. With this, it's anyone you've been less than 6 feet from or touch the same door handles as, maybe in supermarkets or ever. How do you make it comprehensive?
That's a very good question. So contact tracing for COVID is a little bit different, but the basic skill set in terms of how public work you know, public health workers, disease intervention specialists, approach this work is very similar. I mean, this is a respiratory illness. There's many more contacts you need to think about being in touch with, but it's the same skill set. So it is a public health worker who will often notify people by phone or email or social media platforms. It's a very supportive, confidential process where people are educated, informed, navigated through the healthcare system, and there's different levels to the system. So you have your introductory contact tracer, contact investigator. Then you have a tier two person, disease intervention specialist, who supervise those folks and who interact much more centrally with the specific state or local public health surveillance system. And then on top of that, you have what we call medical epidemiologists, clinicians, people who can be available to consult on outbreak response, help people with clinical questions. So contact tracing is not simple, but it is a concept that has been around in our country for a very long time.
And so will your contact tracers ask, Who was that at the supermarket checkout counter right behind you who touched the cart after you touched it? Or who used that public restroom right after you did?
Likely not. So the goal of contact tracers and disease intervention specialists is to help identify people that you've had sustained contact with. So this public health tool does not replace the existing strategies that we know folks need to use, which is social distancing, wearing a mask, wearing gloves when you're out in public. So this isn't meant to try to track down people that you may have had a very brief interaction with on the subway or the grocery store. These are sustained contacts, and that's the goal of what this workforce will tackle.
Where does housing come in? Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb was talking on Morning Edition today about establishing vacant hotels across the country as quarantine centers on a voluntary basis, where people who can't easily isolate at home could be housed until they're cured or cleared, because that's the point of doing this contact tracing, right? It's when the virus isn't so widespread that we can identify individuals who have it and individuals who came in contact with them. We don't have to have this whole population stay home mitigation approach. But then what do we do with those people? Do your people as contact tracers get involved in offering or encouraging quarantine housing?
Well, that's another good question. You know, we have seen around the world governments, you know, take over and house people and isolate them in hotels to separate them out from their households. And that is certainly an option that should be looked at in this country. I don't know how soon that might be happening, however. You know, we have had several coronavirus relief bills that have provided monies to state and local governments. But, you know, so far there's no special funding that's been allocated to do that. So it remains a question about how we may manage that in the future. We are very closely monitoring what Congress is saying on this matter. And Senator Gillibrand from New York recently introduced legislation, which we support, which proposes to add about $55 billion to the public health system to support contact tracers and disease intervention specialists and to fund some of the things, perhaps including housing, which you just mentioned. But the important thing to focus on is, and we don't like to use the word quarantine because I think there's some real stigma associated with that, isolation is really the concept we ought to be focusing in on. How can we support communities, support families and individuals to safely isolate if they've been exposed for a period of time and to minimize the possible exposure of other individuals? So it's a question that remains. This week will be key in the U.S. We are expecting some very specific guidance and plans to come out from the CDC that will help to guide these programs at the state and local level. We know CDC has been working very, very hard 24/7 to get up and running on an enhanced plan in this arena. So we're all very much looking forward to seeing what they issue this week. And then meanwhile, of course, there are plans underfoot, as Governor Cuomo announced, to do a tri-state initiative in partnership with Michael Bloomberg, which is a wonderful new initiative. And that initiative, of course, will need to be coordinated with what's happening at the federal level and with other states across the country.
You mentioned the stigma associated with the word quarantine. I think we have a stigma-related question from David in Elizabeth, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Brian, if this is a civil liberties comment. This might sound like a great idea quantitatively, but I value my doctor-patient privilege. And this is highly, as it sounds now, as softly as one presents it and as kindly as one presents it. And I'm the son of a surgical nurse and I was named after a surgeon. I'm a retired teacher. This is highly intrusive, extremely intrusive. And the question is, what happens if one comes knocking on your door and you refuse to cooperate? Is this going to be an arrest? Now, it may not be at this point, but the way things are going, I think the virus is real. I think it's out there, of course. You know, I was a New York City teacher, but this is highly, highly intrusive. And
which
I would
side,
like to hear, David,
which side would you rather err on?
I would like to have people, this has to be done the right way. Of course people are sick, but I've gone door to door for my church and other things, but this is highly intrusive. The problem is that what kind of penalties is there going to be? Is there going to be coercion? But most of all, privacy. I would like to have, I'll get off the phone, Brian, because this is a great show. And one more second, please. If we had health care for all, and we could maintain a confidentiality between ourselves and the doctors. And I was a member of ACT UP back in the you-know-when, and on 13th Avenue, you know what that's all about. And this is highly intrusive, and I think you guys have to, your guest has to think hardly true about this. And I'll get off. Thank you.
David, thank you very much. And if this is a great show, as you say, it's because of great contributions from people like you. David Harvey, what do you say to this issue, which is obviously a huge issue that the country is only preparing to start talking about? We're going to hear the civil liberties questions more and more, I suspect.
Yes, the other David can talk now. David, your caller raised really good fundamental questions about this system, and this is the time to talk about this. Within the public health system of the United States, we have a very long history of doing this work in a very confidential manner. And people who specialize in contact tracing and doing work who are disease intervention specialists have all kinds of protocols about safeguarding information. Our public health system in the U.S. today collects health information like COVID because it's important to count the cases. And of course, it's important to support people confidentially navigate through the system. But you are right, there will be a lot of questions that come up around this. And we're already seeing particularly these privacy concerns in the context of the apps that companies are developing. We've seen this around the world, but here in the US, as soon as tomorrow, Google and Apple are supposed to release a app that you can use on your phone that is going to, if you opt in on it, use geolocation services to help identify your risk or coming near other folks who have identified as having been exposed. Now, we think there's enormous privacy concerns about that. We know the companies are working hard on that. Nothing really replaces, though, the existing public health workforce that we have that tackles these issues in a very confidential manner. There was a very big debate around contact tracing in the context of the HIV epidemic in the U.S.
Yes, there was.
And yes, there sure were. And raging debates about this many years ago. But the longer history of this comes from the STD sector and other infectious disease outbreaks. If you have a local foodborne illness outbreak, when we were experiencing Zika, Ebola, public health contact tracing is a core function of state and local governments in getting on top of infectious disease outbreaks. So I think that there is a way to do this that very much safeguards people's privacy.
There also, to this point, needs to be a high degree of cultural sensitivity here, right? We know poor people and people of color are disproportionately affected, and many immigrants and people of color, for many good present and historical reasons, distrust that public health officials have their best interest in mind. What are some of the ways that contact tracers build trust to even have the message heard?
Very important, excellent issue you raise. And, you know, some of these are the same concerns expressed by the HIV community around doing contact tracing. But going back years to the Tuskegee experiments in the South, where poor black men were allowed to live with syphilis so that they could be studied by researchers, the public health system in the United States does not have a great history here. And this field has worked ever since to overcome that stigma and distrust and legacy of racism. And so, disease intervention specialists overwhelmingly are people who come from the communities they serve. It's an essential element of doing this work. So the majority of this workforce, and by the way, it's only about 2,000 people as it currently exists across the country. That's going to rapidly increase as communities do new hires. But these are people who are overwhelmingly Latino and African American. They come from the communities they serve because a core aspect of public health is to build trust. If we don't have trust within the system, we're not going to be able to deal with infectious disease outbreaks. If people don't trust the system, they won't ask for help. It's the core element of how we work.
Lisa in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. My sister and I are senior citizens who are very articulate, very educated, very informed, and we'd like to be contact tracers. We're very curious about people and love people, and we want to know what we could use some part-time work. So how would we go about that?
All right, David, there's
great.
The where do I apply question.
That's a great question.
Right, and on the same day that the applications are opening for the Personal Paycheck Protection Act, round two, for small businesses who've had to lay off people, or sometimes people for themselves who've been laid off or lost their income. How about if some of those folks want to sign up to work as contact tracers, if that's where the hiring is going to be?
Yeah, I'm so happy your caller called in with this question. My organization and other national public health groups have been inundated with phone calls from folks asking how to apply for one of these jobs. So here's what you need to know. Take a look at the state and your local county or city health department website for job postings. And you will see job postings right away on those websites. In addition, the CDC Foundation is hiring people as well who will ultimately be placed at the local level. So there will be a lot of job opportunities in this area. Today, my organization working with ASTO, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers, is unveiling a one-day, eight-hour online training for contact tracers that we will be building upon in the coming weeks. There is not really a national online training, you know, that specifically kind of takes what we know about contact tracing and applies it to COVID. So that training is coming out today. We're really hopeful it's going to make a difference at the state and local level. But that's how I would respond to the question. So take a look at the health department job postings in the state of New York. There will be many people hired. Across the country, people have called for between a workforce of 100,000 people to 300,000 people. So there will be lots of job opportunities here. And entry-level contact tracers, you really can come from any background, but you will need to be trained on how to work with people, how to build rapport, build trust, how to understand people's different backgrounds and cultures and to be able to effectively do this job.
You say eight-hour training. I heard on one show this weekend that it takes a year to really train a contact tracer. That struck me as too long. Like, that's not really how long it takes to train someone, a full year. But 8 hours strikes me as pretty short to train someone in the right questions to ask, the cultural sensitivity we were talking about for people who may not be from the same cultural background as yourself. What can you accomplish in 8 hours, and what happens after that?
Again, a really good question. So this initial eight-hour training is the basics. It is a streamlined training. It's designed to reach people to get them immediately with a baseline level of skills so that they can start to work. But it does not replace some of the additional ongoing supervision and training that they need. I've actually been widely quoted as saying it takes a year to train a disease intervention specialist. So that is true. An average disease intervention specialist is someone with advanced skills. Typically what happens is that you're trained through very in-depth coursework, and then you are mentored and supervised for a year. So obviously...
Wait, we're going to run out of time, but is a disease intervention specialist the same as or different from a contact tracer?
Contact tracers are tier one. Disease intervention specialists are tier two. So they're more advanced, much more advanced contact tracers. So the eight-hour training is for basic entry-level folks who are brand new to public health. They'll do that initial training, and then they'll receive additional training at the local and state level.
A very interesting introduction for many of you to contact tracing, which we're going to hear a lot more about and probably come into personal contact a lot more with as a means of helping society in general reopen from coronavirus. We will leave it there with David Harvey, the executive director of the DC-based National Coalition of STD Directors. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.